Tradition, the Journal of Orthodox Jewish Thought, published by the Rabbinical Council of America, is proud to present A Jewish Philosophy of Man, a lecture series by Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. The Rav delivered this series of 12 lectures in 1958 and 1959 before an audience of Jewish social service professionals as part of a program of the Jewish Education Committee of New York. Using audio files provided by the Toras HaRav Foundation, these recordings have been curated and remastered by Mark Smilowitz in order to provide the best listening and learning experience. For more information, including full transcriptions and supplementary materials for this series, please visit the Tradition website at traditiononline.org/JPM. Lecture 8, The Content of the Covenant of Egypt, the Jewish Existential Community, originally delivered on February 26, 1959.
Comes to the English text of the guide of the perplexed, I'm lost. I mean, I simply can't find anything. I mean, I had trouble finding a chapter. I used a certain text, you cannot get used to another one. Now, let us resume the thread. I mean, we left off last time. We spoke about probably the question of Jewish loneliness and fate and destiny in Judaism. And we said that Judaism can either be conceived and also experienced as a fate, so to say, as a fact imposed upon man, or can also be forged as a destiny, freely accepted and made part of my existential awareness. And we, of course, we said that basically the uniqueness of the Jew express itself in his being a member of a covenantal community. Then we ask what the covenant stands for, and we answer that covenant means commitment. And we are a community of the committed ones. We are committed to some goal, to some ultimate end. We are not free in certain respects. We have assumed obligations. What kind of obligations, we assume? This is exactly the question which I have to take up today, yes. Before I'll speak about the obligation of the covenant, and I said there were two covenants actually reached, and these two covenants will express the uniqueness of the Jew and his peculiar station in society. As I spoke last time, we are old-timers, residents, as Abraham said, and also strangers, sojourners. We are both at home and homeless. We are politically, economically, culturally at home in the United States, but transcendentally, metaphysically, the Jew is a homeless person. He is committed to the beyond. Yes. But before I'm going to analyze the two basic covenants, which in my opinion express the essence and the gist of Judaism, I would like to add just a parenthetic remark. Basically, what we have accepted when we reached a covenant with God in our emergence as a people or as a community, as a charismatic community, is a load, because any commitment is a load on the person. It's a burden. To be committed means to carry a burden, to carry a load. And it's very interesting, in Hebrew, it is something which is almost paradoxical, that the word prophecy, nevuah, in Hebrew, and the word masa, a burden, load, are synonyms. Many times the scriptures, instead of saying Malachi prophesied, so Masa Dvara Deshem Beyad Malachi, the burden of God's word on Malachi. Masa, Mem Sin Aleph. Masa Dvara Deshem Beyad Malachi. In the 12 prophets, the last of the 12 prophets, Masa Dvara Deshem Beyad Malachi. What does it mean, a burden? Apparently, the prophet's task, Judaism is a prophetic religion, was not considered a very easy one, a simple one. It was a load. And a load, if I may say, a transcendental load. There is sometimes one carries a load which is a natural load. This load does not weigh heavily upon the shoulders. But many times the load is a paradoxical one, which cannot be spelled out and interpreted in rational terms. And such a load, which I can experience, but I cannot understand many times, which is beyond my comprehension, but still I cannot cast it off. Somehow, I mean, this load, if I try to cast it off, it begins to trail me like an everlasting shadow. So this load is the load of the prophet. So it means our commitment is a prophetic commitment. And if we say we are a community of committed, it means we are a community of prophets. And Moses said, Moses, we'll take the Bible for instance.
Good. Moses said, will you be so kind and take the Bible? I'll just 1 second. Yes. Yes, this is Numbers, just a moment. Numbers, I don't see the chapters here. Numbers 11, verse 29.
Numbers, it's the fourth book in the Pentateuch. 11, verse 29. I would refer you to verse 27. And there ran a young man and told Moses, it was Joshua, his disciple, and said, Eldad and Medad, names, are prophesying in the camp. He thought that the fact that Eldad and Medad became prophets would annoy Moses because they would emerge as his competitors and they would compete for leadership. And Joshua, the son of Nun, the minister, that means the errand boy, of Moses, from his youth up, answered and said, it is Numbers 11, 28, my Lord Moses, Shademi, so for disobedience, for insubordination, and Moses said unto him, art thou jealous for my sake? Would that all the Lord's people were prophets, that the Lord would put his spirit upon them? Isn't it my wish that all the people of the Lord were prophets, and the Lord should put his spirit on them? That means this is my vision, this is my dream. And if two people, commoners, began to prophesy, accepted the Lord, I mean, this is a happy day. I mean, it's in my calendar. You should not be envious. You should not display jealousy for my sake. This exactly. And the Talmudic expression is, in Yisroel, imeinam nevim, bnei nevim eimo. If they are not prophets themselves, at least they are sons of prophets. It means prophecy is their heritage. What does prophecy mean in this case? With regard to us, the Jewish community as a whole, nothing transcendental, nothing supernatural, nothing metaphysical, but the acceptance of a load, because prophecy basically is a load in Hebrew, masa. Yes, if you allow the Bible, Malachi, masa dvar adeshem al Yisrael v'yad Malachi, it is the 12 prophets. It's falling Ezekiel, but the last of the 12 prophets, the small prophets. The burden of the word of the Lord to Israel by Malachi. This is official English translation, it's a correct translation. I never rely too much on the English translation because it's due to the Vulgata and the Septuaginta, the Greek and the Latin translation, but in this case they are right. The burden of the word of the Lord to Israel by Malachi. It's a burden. Prophecy in the Bible is called Masa, burden, which even though weighs heavily upon the shoulders of the prophet, lends dignity and greatness to man. I wouldn't say it gives him comfort.
but gives him ease, or even peace of mind, but at least dignity and greatness to man. Interesting is the description of Jeremiah. Jeremiah described the burden of the prophet and the solitude I spoke last time. The solitude of the prophet. His loneliness, or as I said last time, his aloneness. In terse but poignant words. And he also let us in on the secret of the response such an experience evokes. Let us quote Jeremiah indirectly by introducing a passage from Maimonides, the guide. Do you have the guide? Is it the same edition? It's part 2, section 2, page 181, if you have the guide. Page 181, part 2, section 2, I believe. It is chapter 37, at the end of the chapter. Chapter 37, are the pages the same? I mean, not no, it's a different edition. But chapter 37, at the end, yes, but the characteristic of the intellect is this. It means the intellect of the prophet. No, before. Will you be so kind that you'll just, but the characteristic. But the characteristic, it is the end of chapter 37, section 2. Maimonides gives a description of the intellect of the prophet. It's a typological description, basically. But the characteristic of the intellect is this. What the intellect of one receives, it means of the prophet, is transmitted to another, and so on, till a person is reached that can only himself be perfected by such... Just a moment. It is further the nature of this element in man. This is exactly the following sentence. That he who possesses an additional degree of that influence, it means the prophet. It's very poor translation. I mean, everyone knows the Arabic and the Hebrew text is a very influence, a very poor translation. Even the Hebrew Ashpa'ah is something else. Anyway, influence is compelled to address his fellow man. There is a compulsion. Under all circumstances, whether he is listened or to or not, even if he injures himself thereby. This is the nature of the prophetic word. A man, there is almost, it is compelling. Action you may call, of course, I mean, it would be ridiculous to apply a psychiatric term, because this means a certain anomaly. It's compulsive on the part of the prophet. He has to do it. Although his best interests tell him, don't do that. Don't get involved. Because you are a rebel against society. You try to overthrow, I mean, social order. You voice protest against accepted sacred institutions. Thus, we find prophets that did not leave off speaking to the people until they were slain. It is this divine influence that moves them, that does not allow them to rest in any way. It's one of the most beautiful chapters in the guide. Maimonides is always grand when he stops philosophizing and speaks in a simple language. When he is not over-sophisticated, my mind is, allow them to rest in any way, though they might bring upon themselves great evils by their action. When Jeremiah was despised, like other teachers and scholars of his age, he could not, though he desired it, he wanted, withhold his prophecy, or cease from reminding the people of the truth which they rejected. And Jeremiah said, he quote Jeremiah, for the word of the Lord was unto me a reproach and the mocking all day. And I said, I will not mention it, nor will I again speak in his name. He wanted to desert his mission, but it was in mine heart a burning fire, enclosed in my bones, and I was wearied to keep it and did not prevail. This is also the meaning of the words of another prophet. The Lord God hath spoken, who shall not prophesy? I mean, who has the ability to suppress the message? And this is not, ladies and gentlemen, the characteristic of the prophet of old. it is basically the characteristic of the Jewish community. Because as I said, we have accepted the burden. The burden is not, we cannot just either cast it off and not to prophesy. We are compelled to prophesy. This is exactly the covenant interpreted more or less in personalistic terms, I would say. Now, let me now examine the covenant itself. This is very important. This is just as a parenthetic remark. If we examine the history of the covenant as portrayed in Exodus, we will find out that God established with his people two covenants. One in Egypt before the Exodus, and the other one at Sinai at the time of Revelation. Now let's open Exodus 6, verses 5, 6, 7. Exodus 6, verses 5, 6, 7. Exodus 6, verses 5, 6, 7. Yes, Exodus 6, verses 5, 6, 7. And more, perhaps we'll go back to verse 2. I am the Lord, and I appeared unto Abraham, unto Isaac, and unto Jacob as God Almighty, but by my name, the four-letter name, Tetragrammaton, I made me not known to them, and I have also established my covenant with them, to give them the land of Canaan, the land of their sojournings, wherein they sojourned. And moreover, I have heard the groaning of the children of Israel, whom the Egyptians keep in bondage, and I have remembered my covenant. Wherefore, say unto the children of Israel, I am the Lord. It means the establishment of the covenant is always, I am the Lord. And I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I will deliver you from their bondage, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great judgment. And again, and I will take you to me. This is the most important sentence in the covenant. And I will take you to me for a people, and I will be to you a God. And ye shall know that I am the Lord your God, who brought you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. This is the covenant. Always the covenant, so to say, the finale of a covenant is, I am your God, you are my people. It's an agreement, contract. Basically, it's a contract. This is the first covenant that I spoke of at the Exodus. Now, if you'll take the book of Exodus, the same book, chapter 19, instead of chapter 6, chapter 19, verses 4 and 5. The famous address to Moses before the revelation. It's very famous. 4:19, verse 4. Ye have seen what I did unto the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings, and brought you unto myself. Now, therefore, if ye will hearken unto me, unto my voice, indeed, and keep my covenant, there ye shall be mine own treasure from among all peoples, for all the earth is mine, and ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. I emphasis placed upon the last two words, holy nation. Now, it's very interesting. The covenant of Egypt, but I must introduce here a Hebrew term, because in English, of course, you have the two terms, but they don't correspond. The covenant of Egypt, if you'll go back to chapter 6, Exodus chapter 6, verse 7. and I will take you to me for a people. In Hebrew it is, Vilokachti eschem li le'om, a people, concluding man, a people. So it's God speaks in terms of a people, as in Hebrew means I'll have to operate with this term, ayin, mem stuma, it means the concluding mem, ayin, the people. Here, he says the word goy kadosh, goy. I mean, in Yiddish, in vernacular, goy has assumed a funny, I don't know how it developed, but a funny meaning. I mean, goy means an angel, but goy basically means a nation. This is a nation. Apparently, it was so. I mean, how it developed, and I can imagine how it developed. The Talmud dealt with pagans. So the pagan was Akum. Of course, then when the Christian society came up, so they eliminated the word pagans because Christians are not pagans. So they had to describe a non-Jew. How can you say a non-Jew? It means a man who belongs to another nation, of another nationality. So apparently at the beginning it was Goy Acher, a different nationality. So finally the printer decided, why do they have the name, why do they need the qualification Acher? So they left the word Goy. And Goy means a nation. This is how it has developed over the ages, basically. But basically Goy means, in Hebrew means, Goy Kadosh means a holy nation. If I should say in English, but it is bad, it is in sense of political science and sociologically, it would not correspond semantically. In the covenant, with regard to the covenant of Egypt, God speaks in terms of peoplehood. With regard to the covenant at Mount Sinai, he speaks in terms of nationhood, Goy Kadosh. You'll be my people. In Sinai, he says, you'll be a sacred nation. And I'm not speaking about the sacredness, about the adjectival qualification of sacredness. I'm not concerned for the time being with that. We'll come later what sacredness means in Judaism. But here is Goy, and there is Am. What's the difference between peoplehood and nationhood? But you see, when you look up a dictionary on political science, you'll get it completely a different view. Because, for instance, in English you can say the American nation consists of many peoples. So people actually means something, we have a racial origin, common origin. A nation basically means a political society in the colloquial now, in the vernacular. I don't mean the vernacular, in the scientific vernacular. But this is not what I'm going. Basically, a nation from the Latin natus, born, basically has nothing to do with a political society. But I'll orientate myself not according to the established, so to say, definitions of the which you'll find in any political dictionary, a dictionary of political science, but what in Hebrew means I'm a people and goy a nation. That's what I want to describe. Am in Hebrew basically means im, together. Because in Hebrew if you say, I was with him, so say, ani bati imado, or im chaveri, im yididi. I came with him. So it means, im means together. So out of im, the noun, the term am, was formed, you see, was emerged, and am denotes togetherness. Denotes togetherness. Unity. Apparently, let us not speak about the covenant at Sinai. Let us take up the covenant in Egypt. The covenant in Egypt apparently committed us. It's again a commitment, again a load, and again, if I may use a term by Plato, Maimonides, and Kierkegaard, it was a mad commitment, a crazy commitment, paradoxical, absurd commitment, but it was that. Of course, we are too practical, perhaps if we had been consulted, we wouldn't have accepted it. But apparently our parents forefathers, it was not as practically minded and as pragmatically orientated as we are, so we accepted, but it's a crazy commitment. Paradoxical means a togetherness commitment. That's all, nothing else. A togetherness commitment. The covenant in Egypt committed us to a community existence. Because to get, basically, am means community. Community, and I would say, I would add one phrase, there are so many communities. There are political communities and scientific communities and educational communities and all kinds of communities. Because there is a community, I mean, any common denominator, I mean, creates a community. I would say it was an existential community. Our very existence as individuals and as members of a society is a together existence. A together existence, not a single existence. The covenant addresses itself, the covenant in Egypt, prima facie, not only prima facie, but actually primarily, I would say, primarily address itself to the numinous I, about whom I spoke in the last lectures. To the I, I would say not the numinous I, but the numinous Jew. To man, to the Jew in seclusion. To the I in seclusion or the Jew in seclusion. To man or to the Jew for himself. To solitary Abraham. If Adam is the symbol of man in general, is Abraham the symbol of the Jew in general? To solitary Abraham. And commends him, the man who is sheltered by his ego existence. Somehow he's afraid to tear down the barrier separating him from the Tao. The covenant addresses itself, or God through the covenant addressed himself to the numinous Jew and commanded him to become accustomed to live with the other self. It's a great ability, it's a great art. Covenant contract. A covenant, the mere word covenant, the mere word ka, the Latin ka, what does it mean? It's already together. Like im in Hebrew, means together, ka. Whatever does in Latin ka is together, to get, convene together, to be together, to live together. The covenant contract means something which grows out of a relationship between two beings, I and thou. The numinous I, whenever he enters a contractual arrangement with God, first of all, the covenant is established between man and God. But the moment a man reaches an agreement with God, he ipso facto commits himself also to the finite thou. Because God never enters in agreement with the individual unless this is Judaic thinking. Unless the individual is ready to commit himself not only to God, but we call it in our vernacular, the infinite Tao, not only this commitment is not as important to God as the commitment to the finite Tao. God says, yeah, we'll enter an agreement, but not only between two people. If we are going to reach an agreement, form a community, I want three members. The community, three members should comprise the community. Who are the three members? Who are they? I, God, thou, and he. Basically, a covenant is composed of three people. Of the three personae of the grammar, I mean. Basically, it is the three personae of the grammar. It is I, thou, and he. Of course, man can say, I'm an aristocrat, I don't want to join him. It is not below my dignity to reach an agreement with God. I can't have, so say, social intercourse with God. He's a prominent citizen. But I'm a little bit reluctant to join that Tao. Tao doesn't come up to me socially, economically, educationally. So there is no agreement. It is I, capital I, Tao, and he. Of course, Tao and he is small. This is im, together, but not together with God, together with God, and with another finite being whom you don't like. Of course, the individual, numinous self, who was in seclusion, if he accepts the agreement, then it tries to, if he accepts the agreement, this is the conditio sine qua non. Otherwise, no agreement is reached. If he accepts the terms of the agreement, so he tries, or has to try at least, to liberate himself from solitude. It's an act. To liberate himself from solitude and join hands with the other self. The other self is also a bit stubborn and obstinate, and he is also hiding in the recesses of his own personality. He doesn't want to come out of this warm shelter. But he's forced by the covenant. Come out! Emerge! Out of your head. Covenant basically means fellowship. Of God, as I said, I, thou, and he. The first emergence, basically what happens? Charismatic man. I spoke about numinous man and charismatic man. Who forces numinous man to emerge into the open, to pass on his message to society, and to become a member of society, of a community? Who forces him? Religiously, of course, sociologically, you have many forces, I mean, anthropologically. But I'm speaking now from the standpoint of religion. Who forces numinous, the numinous Jew, to become a member of a community? Regardless whether it is in accordance with his interests, or it is sometimes, I mean, as my man says, sometimes he may inflict injury upon himself by committing himself to others. Who forces him? The covenant. Man, secluded man, looks for companionship. Although it's sometimes very hard to get out, I mean, of this, of his shelter, because of the covenant. Out, charismatic man, out of the recesses of his numinous existence. And this occurs with the establishment of a covenantal society. The community is a strange one. It's a strange community. It is an all-inclusive fellowship. The difference between the Judaic community and the secular community, the sociological community, is only one. It's the one difference. The sociological community is I, thou, and he. Correct? That's all. I mean, all the three persona of the grammar form a community, nothing else. If you have many, so it's in plural. It's we, you, and they. That's all, nothing else. The Jewish community, the biblical community, and this is a community which was accepted in Jewish history, I mean, theologically, is a community also. I, thou, he, small, and he, capital. That's all. There is a fourth member to the community. And the fourth member of the community is God himself. It's a community of finitude and infinity. It's an all-inclusive community. The sociological community is restricted, confined to the dimensions of finitude, while the Judaic community is an all-inclusive community. It's finitude plus infinity. Of course, mathematically, it's a paradox. Because if you take finitude plus infinity, mathematically, it equals infinity. Correct. So it means finitude disappears. But in our viewpoint, there is a place for finitude, for finite man, to exist in the presence of God. God does not consume man, does not smother him. Man and God can be two equal fellows in one society. There is a funny approach in Judaism Christianity had never understood in its life. Never. There is equality between God and man on the one hand, and of course on the other hand, it is an endless gap. But on the one hand, God is my friend. Now you have it. Adeshem rei le echsa is quite possible, so we all translate God is my shepherd, I shall not want. But it's quite possible that the real interpretation, Nachmanides wants to say so, is God is my friend, my colleague, I shall not want. But basically, in Hebrew, is roi a shepherd, and rei a colleague might stem from the same origin. Yes, the covenant, now let's come back. This is the covenant in Egypt. This covenant, this sort of a covenant was established in Egypt. The covenant of Am, let us stick to the Hebrew term because it expresses, I mean, the very essence of the covenant. The covenant of Am, of togetherness, of a community existence, of a fellowship of I, thou, he and he, capital, finds expression, I would say, at many levels. And I want to say it in practical terms. Up here it was a bit that I operated with some abstract terms, but Judaism is always like any metaphysical idea. To see any metaphysical idea translated into practical terms. If it cannot be expressed in practical terms and made and converted into a norm to guide man, metaphysics, in the opinion of the Judaic, of Judaism, has no significance. It means like that, together. It's a covenant of together, yeah? Togetherness. And let me make it very simple. First, togetherness in the present. Togetherness in the present. It means community, and please note each word, because I'm going to explain it. Community of interest. Feelings and responsibilities. Community of interests, feelings, and responsibilities. And I would say more than interests, feelings, and responsibilities, I would say a community of experiences. This would cover everything. And a community of experiences, both passional experiences, it means experiences of suffering, passio, passional experiences, and also eudaimonic experiences, experiences of happiness. At both. So number one, but in the present, right here and now. Second, this is the covenant. This is what the covenant requires of us. This is the law. Second, together at the level of the historical drama. Unity of the historical drama. Or unity of the historical occurrence. Or together in all three dimensions of time. Together in the past, or rather together with the past. I would say rather, together with the past, which is gone, together with the future, which hasn't been born yet. It is together of events which have almost faded out of our memory, together with events which have not yet taken place. It means together in memory and together in hope. Together in retrospect and together in vision and hope and dream. This is the second element of the covenant. Now let us analyze, I'm back. Let us analyze the covenant as far as it pertains to the present. To the present. The covenant, as I said, a community of interests, responsibilities, and experiences. Passional and eudaimonic. Means present experiences and unpleasant experiences. What does it mean? In practical terms, a very simple practical terms. It's no use, beating around the bush in such matters. You have to spell it out the way Judaism tried to spell it out. You should never make it a life of philosophy. This is the trouble with now modern existentialism, if applied to Judaic problems. It's a very nice philosophy, many times. I asked one of the leaders, all right, but I asked him in Yiddish, what is the tachlis? All right, everything said and done. So what is the conclusion? What shall we do? So the Jew always asked, what shall I do? The Greek asked, what is it? But the Jew, in order to understand what he should do, he must understand what the world stands for, of course. What is the problem with the prophet? What does God demand from you? What does he want? Never mind. Metaphysics. Together in the present, this covenantal commitment can be spelled out again, gentlemen, is together in the present at three practical I would say, in three practical different areas of endeavor. First of all, unity of interests. I would say solidarity. All Jews, that's what Judaism tries to tell us many times, all Jews share the same historical destiny. No Jew, however prominent or anonymous, regardless, perhaps very prominent and anonymous, nobody, may submerge in the crowd and disappear, and by so doing, escape the destiny of our people. No one is exempted from the terms of the common historical affairs. There are no exemptions in the Jewish community. Differences as to color, because basically we are people, funny people. It's hard to say we are one race here. I mean, if judged by criteria, anthropological criteria, I don't care about it anymore. Because to us, Judaism, the convert, the proselyte, is just the same aristocrat as the high priest. I mean, so these racial elements absolutely play no role in Judaism. Judaism, if there is some charismatic endowment in Judaism, it's not a biological endowment. Our blood, our body is the same. It is the load. It depends how much of a load we carry. And of course, if one carries a bigger load, this might be a chosen person, of course. Yes. And if one tries to lighten his load, of course, he's not as chosen as another one. And it's up to us, I mean, to be chosen or to be like any other people or to be below the level of any other people. I always say, the Jew basically has two alternatives. He hasn't got three. It's either he's above other people or he's below. Like others is a heart, I don't know. It's hard to be like others. I don't know. Here we are. You see, the Midrash says, Umazu, this nation, when it begins to ascend, it may reach the stars. And when it begins to roll down the hill, it may reach unfathomable depths. I mean, sink to very low. Anyway, let's. Differences in the color of the skin, cultural diversity, economic discrepancies, language, dress, morals, and differences in the general social milieu must not dispel the feeling of solidarity which binds all Jews together. Whether they live in the culturally advanced Western societies, or in the Far East, or in Israel, or in North Africa, whether they live on Park Avenue, or in the Mela, in Algiers, or in Algeria.
They all are exposed to similar vicissitudes of history. And I want you to know, this is not a prophecy of doom. It's a certain approach that there is no aristocracy in Judaism.
I don't mean aristocracy in the sense of blue blood, but I mean aristocracy. No Jew can say what happened to X cannot happen to me. This is a mistake, gentlemen. I'm very far. I resent very much when Zionist leaders of the Ben-Gurion begins to tell us how unreliable the diaspora is. And I don't say the diaspora is very reliable. I don't say. But I say something else. If the diaspora is not reliable, so is Israel. If, I must use the Hebrew expression, chas v'shalom, the day should come on which the American government and the American people should turn anti-Semitic and begin to pass anti-Jewish legislation and engage in a campaign of religious persecution or minority persecution, then, of course, we have no shelter here. But he won't have any shelter in Israel. Ridiculous. Many times, not him personally, because I never met him, but the Zionist leaders, it is crazy because it's nonsensical. Because the security in Israel's safety depends upon the American, the Western society. If we are not only the United States, for the United States as the leading country, but the Western society should go on anti-Semitic, and there is no safety in Israel. On the contrary, I believe there will be more safety in America, even in an anti-Semitic America, than Israel, with Nasser on the one hand and Qassim on the other. It's ridiculous. So it's not a prophecy of doom. But however, there is no security, because all the human being has no security, always. But this American ideal that a man can find security is false. A man has no security as an individual. As I said many times, if I have a big bank account, so am I secure? I'm not secure because the vicissitudes of life are not only in the economic area. This today I can move my fingers, next day I cannot move my fingers. So okay, there is this security. Who can secure me against a heart attack or a shock or a paralytic shock? Who can secure me? It's ridiculous when people speak about security. There's no security. And the Jew, to say I am secure and that's all, is ridiculous. I say it for many reasons, ladies and gentlemen, I say it because this is the sense. It's not, first of all, this is the prevailing mood in Judaism, but it's not pessimism, understand? It's not pessimism. It's like a Jew. A Jew is never secure as a person. On the other hand, the Jew is an optimist. It's a combination. I'll say the Jew thinks in dialectical terms. The thesis is right, but the antithesis is also right. The thesis is right, no one is secure. The antithesis is also right, a man should feel secure as far as possible. What there is, you see, if you operate with the thesis and antithesis, you understand? It's a dialectical thinking. You don't operate with ultimates. Either this or that, no. But then it's a different, you develop a different approach. I am saying that for two reasons. I told you, my interpretation of Judaism is not objective. There's no person who interprets Judaism can be objective. Judaism is an experience. An experience is very, as personality is very. Of course, my interpretation of Judaism is an outgrowth of my own personality, my own experiences. I lived for many years in Germany. The good years, the seven good years, we say it in biblical language. And Germany was ruled by social democracy in the 20s. And then the German Jew, of course, in Poland, we used to have in Poland and in Lithuania, used to have anti-Semitic violence and outbreaks from time to time. So German Jews, assimilated Jews, I mean, all German Jews were assimilated, whether they were pious or not pious, but they were assimilated. And don't forget, the German society, Jewish society, was integrated into the German society by far more than the American Jewish society is integrated in the American society, because integration is a problem of years. It's not a question which you can bring it about by changing the language. It's a question of morals and it's a way of thinking. And don't forget that the German Jewish society was as old almost as the German civilized society. You tell me what happened in Poland cannot happen either. It's impossible. And of course, I mean, Hitler was on this scene a little bit, but of course he was more a comical figure in 1926, 1927, 1925. He was a comical figure. No one paid attention, serious attention to him. A crackpot from Vienna who didn't speak a decent German. He spoke a grammatically wrong, faulty German. It's a fact. He never learned how to speak German properly. Even when he was the leader, the Führer of the German people, it cannot happen. And I always felt a certain sense of complacency about it. Complacency and security. That's exactly, it happened. It could have happened in Germany, and Germany, and then to say it is, that Germany is different from all nations, it's ridiculous. The Germans, although I knew many Germans, good Germans and bad Germans, very cultured people, as far as culture is concerned, they are second to none. I mean, far. Philosophy, metaphysics, and who wrote beautiful books about ethics, if not the German people, I mean, the categorical imperative, so a man should sacrifice himself for the categorical imperative, and so forth, that even the notlüge, the necessary lie, one shouldn't say even necessary lie to save his life, who did it, who said it, if not Fichte, the famous German philosopher, but still, why is it? Because human beings can be either devils or angels, and we are all human beings. I'm not sure that even in Israel, Hitler is impossible. Even Israel is possible. We are also human beings. With all our charismatic endowment, we are still human beings. And a human being is not reliable, that's all. You know what David says? All men are liars. It's correct, but it doesn't mean you shouldn't trust men, but you should always remember that. Watch out, yes. You know that the Talmudic expression, Kabdeyu vechashdeyu. pay him respect, but watch out.
No wonder you can't be secure.
Not so much for pickpockets, Mr. Carr. And vicissitudes of life. And there are biological vicissitudes, and there are also historical vicissitudes. At certain periods, a nation might go crazy. Might run amok. A nation. Not an individual. We saw it with Germany. Now Germans are sober people again. All right, you have some anti-Semites, I mean crackpots. And we have crackpots here too, so who cares about it? But the Jewish history wants the solidarity of hate. Yes, disaster for one community, Judaism said, even though distant from and strange to the other community, must alarm and summon to defensive action all Jewish communities. If one community finds itself in trouble.
Because there's a contradiction here of the statement, this is one world, but one world for Jews only, apparently, because certainly in our practice, again, perhaps it's not true generally, but in America here, our practice around different religions, around different colors, around different practices, even among some of us Jews, doesn't testify to an observance of this one world for others.
Basically, I'll tell you, basically, I'm speaking now about one world for Jews, one destiny, I wouldn't say one world. Basically, later I'll show you that what Judaism demands parochially from the Jew, see, within the Jewish community, it also, demanded from the Jew universally. So the Jew should consider himself a part of humanity and also consider that the common destiny of humanity is one. But we start as Jews and we climb up little by little to the another level, the universal level. That's exactly, it is correct. But whether American Jews have it or not, it's hard for me to say. I believe they have it. I'll speak about it. I believe I was wondering whether American Jews have this experience of the covenant of Im, whether they have it or not. I was wondering many times, and I arrived at many, at different conclusions at many times, at various times. But the final conclusion is, as I go older, either I become wiser or more foolish, I don't know. But I am more convinced that American Jew has this feeling for the covenant. Whether he spells it out or not, it's a different story. American Jews feels a lot and doesn't dare to say many things. There is a lot he feels, intuitively knows a lot of American Jews. Somehow there's an inner fear about American Jew to spell out what he feels.
You're saying philosophically then we have...
I would say even that philosophically, each American Jew feels himself a part of the general Jewish community, not only the American Jewish community. The general Jewish community, I don't, because it is so. But the American Jew, I know many American fathers are afraid to tell their children what they feel. What they feel about themselves, somehow. I don't know, there's a certain reluctance about American Jew to say what he is, what he stands for. Many times it's hide and seek, game, play the American Jew. But let me continue, because this is just the first aspect. All Jewish community, not because of sympathy you must help them, and pity, but for the distinct feeling of involvement of the Jew with the fate of the other Jew, regardless of the endless distance, geographically, culturally, and politically, separating one Jew from another. If a Jew tries to desert his people and to flee the common destiny to which he was committed, he is dragged back by a cruel and cynical fate. I feel impelled to refer you again to the story of Jonah, which is impregnated with symbolism, how he is dragged back to God, whom he tried to flee and to desert. Interesting is the story in the Bible. Moses, before he was elected to become the redeemer of the Jewish people, had to go through a funny experience. Moses, the prince, the darling of Pharaoh, leaves the royal palace and walks out and goes out to his brother and witnesses a very paradoxical, episode. An Egyptian taskmaster smiting a Hebrew slave, one of his brother. See, basically, if you take a look at Exodus, The Bible is very terse, but one word conveys the idea. If you take Exodus 2, verse 11, Exodus 2, chapter 2, verse 11. And it came to pass in those days, when Moses was grown up, that he went out unto his brethren and looked under burdens. What kind of brethren were they to him? What kind of brothers were they to him? He was not raised in the ghetto, Moses, according to the biblical story. He was raised in the royal palace. What kind of brothers were they to him? And what impelled Moses to leave the premises of comfort and luxury, of oriental comfort and luxury, and go to the slave camp, to a concentration camp, and witness, so to say, the travail and the pain and suffering of some strangers, of some Hebrews, whom he didn't know, as a matter of fact. What impelled him? I don't know what impelled him, but if you'd ask me, some inner force, compulsive force, something impelled him. And brethren, and he looked on their burdens. What does it mean he looked on their burdens? What does it mean he looked on their burdens? That means he looked on their burdens. It's not a question of looking. I mean, he experienced their burdens. Of course, the Bible didn't have the expression experience. Looking means participating, sharing the burdens. And what did he see? Vayarish mitzri makei shivrimech. And he saw an Egyptian smiting a Hebrew, one of his brother. And what Moses did, he defended him. What does it show? That before the Redeemer, Moses was elected as Redeemer and leader, he had to do one thing, identify himself with the people. If he hadn't identified himself with the people, he could have never been elected the Messiah of Israel. Messiah of Israel does not come from the aristocracy, does not come from the above, from the higher strata. He comes from out of the midst of the crowd. And the crowd was in the ghetto. Moses had to identify himself. Moses culturally, psychologically, he was a different person. He was an Egyptian. You see, when he came to Midian and he helped the daughters of Yethro, and they came home, and the father asked them, why did you come home so quickly? So he said, Ish Mitzri, an Egyptian, helped us. So he looked like an Egyptian. Moses was completely assimilated, apparently, at that time. He was reared in the palace of Pharaoh. What dragged him, to the Jews, to the poor, dirty Jews in the slaves, in the ghetto in Goshen? What dragged him? I don't know what dragged him. The covenant hasn't been established yet, but apparently what was to be established later, Moses already experienced intuitively before. Dragged him, the feeling of common destiny, identification.
Well, while in the palace, wasn't Moses aware of the Jews?
He was aware of
the stories of his mother?
Yes, stories of the mother, correct, when she nursed him. But don't forget, nursing, basically, the mother nursed him. Basically, as much as we know now, we can know pretty well about it with our sources. The nursing period, it means she was nursed by the breast, probably took about 24 months. So it means, and then said that the mother brought him back to Pharaoh after completing the period of nursing. Moses, when he came out, a two-year-old child, was returned back, he was returned to the palace. I don't believe he had any memories of his mother. And let us assume that his mother was in touch with him. Although I cannot imagine whether it was possible or not. Because the difference between the king, of Egypt and a poor Hebrew woman, a slave. I don't know, there could be much intercourse, between the palace and the ghetto. But he was reared in Egyptian culture. What dragged him out of them? I don't know, it's hard to say. We just have fragments. But this is apparently the covenant. Interesting is Maimonides, in enumerating those to whom he shared in the hereafter, in the future world, who will be denied because of grave offenses, writes of the Jew, who is indifferent to the suffering and the travail of his people as follows. I am quoting him verbatim,
course, I translate into English, and if you want to have the source, I can give you. The laws pertaining to conversion, Tshuva, chapter 3, paragraph 20. One who separates himself from the community, he will never share the bliss of the world to come. This is, in Judaism, it is the severest punishment. Even if he does not commit a transgression, and even if he is pious, observes all laws of the Torah, only holds himself aloof from the congregation, of Israel, does not fulfill religious precepts in common with his people. He fulfills all religious precepts, but not in common with his people. Shows himself indifferent when they are in distress. Does not observe their fast. A fast is an expression of solidarity, an expression of sympathy with the persecuted, but goes his own way as if he were one of the Gentiles and did not belong to the Jewish people. Such a person has no portion in the world. It's interesting, even an Orthodox Jew, even a fanatic belonging to the lunatic French, I don't care how Orthodox he is, if you let this covenantal experience of togetherness in the story with regard to historical destiny, he's not considered to be a good Jew. Now, this sharing of interest, community of interest, leads to something else. Community of feeling, emotional involvement. The community It means he should not only, so to say, keep intellectually see himself a part of the Jewish community, but simply experience both at the passional and eudaimonic level all the pleasure, all the travail, pain, sufferings, and distress of other parts of the community. Compassion or co-suffering with others is basic in our commitment. The experience of the Jew, whether tragic or joyful, must be keenly shared and perceived, entered into and shared by all. To suffer with the oppressed and rejoice with the free is a part of our community. This is first at an intellectual level, to consider himself a part of the community. Not to think that I can escape. I am different because I am more cultured, I am richer, I am more prominent. What happened to the poor Jew cannot happen to me. Secondly, I should feel it. This commitment should not only be thought out in intellectual terms, but felt. But here we come to the third and perhaps the most important aspect of this common destiny knowledge and experience. This is a community of responsibilities. It's very important.
Judaism has stressed time and again this community.
This awareness of community of interests and experiences leads to a community, to a third community, of responsibilities. And community of responsibilities, again, can be seen at two levels. First of all, we are morally accountable for each other. This is the Judaic concept. All Israel are Evim Zelazeh. All Jews are morally accountable, answerable, before the Almighty for the errors of their fellow men or their fellow brothers. We must answer for the conduct of our brother to a degree that no other national group experiences it. Basically, I'm not speaking now from a halakhic viewpoint, from a historical viewpoint. Somehow I don't know why it is so. I don't know. I cannot explain it. Perhaps it is due to some anomalous thinking on the part of the Gentile world, but it is a fact that the world places upon us collective liability and answerability. It is a historical paradox, yet the paradoxality does not diminish our togetherness in the eyes of the non-Jewish society with regard to our moral responsibility. This is the most important thing. Let me illustrate this paradox with an example from current events. We all know too well, and I happen to know it very well, because I went through it, what the name Marx, or the name Trotsky, or Zinoviev, meant to the anti-Semitic bigot. That's what I want to emphasize. There are certain questions, for instance, I'll give you an example with Israel. We know that some Gentiles attack us for double loyalties, for divided loyalties, for divided commitments with regard to Israel. And I must tell you, I myself am a member of the Zionist Party, I mean the religious Zionist wing. But it is a problem for the American Jew. It's not like people in the Theodor Herzl Institute want to do away with this problem. It's a problem. It's got to be thought out properly. And if the question is posed to us, and it's posed to me very often, we should know what answer. What about the Catholic? There's no answer about the Catholic. Because the Catholic is not as committed to Ireland as we are committed to Israel. There's one difference. And if you think we know that, I can tell you that the intelligent Gentiles know it well. See. But what troubles me is not some literature published by Herbert Gerald Smith. This is a threat, but what troubles me is that decent Gentiles, people who have no prejudice against the Jews, keep on asking me the same question. And I mean it. Same question. So apparently, you see, the person who is somehow the hateful person says it aloud. The person who is not hateful, a normal person, with understanding the intelligent Gentile, asks a question. And if the question is asked, never try to put the question the way it's best. But try to answer. I mean, this is a different problem. I'll perhaps analyze this problem. We should know this problem, how to encounter if we are challenged. Yeah. But even with communism, it raises questions in the minds of the Gentiles. Even a decent non-Jew remarked to me the other day, when he read about the arrest of a Jew as a communist spy, agitator, of course, it's very bad. But he said, it seems to me, of course, he spoke, he's a sociologist by profession, so he can afford the luxury of speaking in impersonal terms. So in the science is also a license for sin, you see. So it's very well to be a scientist, you can do anything you want. As religion sometimes is a license for sin. So it seems to me, certainly very nicely, very swelly, as if the Jew willingly sympathizes with these revolutionary ideas, and it's of course due to their historical experiences, he said to me. Of course, it's not an indictment of the Jew, never mind indictment or no indictment, but he said it to me. Historical experience. Somehow, because the Jew is questing for justice, for equality, he thinks that he can find justice and equality in the communist order. That's what he told me. Very nicely phrased. I cannot say anything against it. So, all right. But it means the problem bothers him. Why is it? It's a sense of collective responsibility. On the other hand, however, gentlemen, none, not even the craziest person, someone in an inmate of Bellevue Hospital, will blame the Chinese in America, or even the Chinese in Formosa, for Mao Zedong and Chulin, and the powerful communization of Asia, carried out by the Chinese people. Imagine, gentlemen, if Israel would go communist. Imagine. And it's also possible. Everything is possible to me. Israel went communist. Imagine our luck here. You know what we, I don't know what we, I don't know what the world would say to us. And Israel, a communist Israel would not be dangerous to society. Who cares? Two more million people coming. Poor. And actually people without security, safety. And here is a great empire of 600 million people communist. No one is blaming a Chinese man. In America, for simple reason, why the Chinese in America is either an American resident or an American citizen. He's not to be blamed for Mao Zedong, of course. Collective responsibility is a primitive way of thinking. This is a scapegoat psychology, to put all these things on the scapegoat, on this innocent goat. Yes, but somehow it works with regard to us. I don't know why it is so. I'm not a psychologist, I'm not an anthropologist. It's hard for me to explain, But it's a fact. That's the... Yes, Mr. Cigar.
Yeah, if I worry about it this way, we can take the case of a communist. And how many countries have communists been active in revolution other than in China itself?
And you mean who, the Chinaman? Or the whole Asia? You know, China now is the greatest danger. Yeah. Russia is no danger now. China is communist. There is a communization of Asia. We didn't lose the war, the Cold War in Europe. We lost the Cold War in Asia because there is steady communization of Asia. And you'll see, I don't want to be a prophet of doom. I'm afraid that Asia will go communist, including India. Because there is no force which can resist communism in Asia. And still no one blames the Chinese.
The fact is that historically so far, people have attributed Jews with liberalism, with radicalism, and I think historically it has been true.
How many Jews were active in the liberal movement? I happen to know very well the Russian history. How many Jews, here and there, during the revolution there were a few Jews, you know, you have Kamenev, Trotsky, all right, but there are more Russians. I mean, there is something which I cannot understand, yes.
Well, this is, there is
a
story, maybe it's apocryphal, about your own father with relation to a Russian Jewish revolutionary.
About my grandfather, yes.
Is that true?
And it's true story.
Right. Well, there is an
example of the... No, this is nothing to do. You know the story about my grandfather, about the rabbi in Brie, the famous of time. The once revolutionary of the social revolutionaries, I mean, they believed in terror. Social democracy in Russia did not believe in terror. They thought to bring it about by, say, by... to an educational campaign in terror. So when the governor general of Warsaw, the district of Poland, that time was a part of Russia, was killed by a bomb, a boy from Brisk, from the town he was rabbi, was involved. And of course, it meant the court martial and death. My grandfather, whether he didn't believe in his guilt, or he believed in his guilt, but he thought, you know what I mean, for killing the general governor general in Warsaw, a Jewish boy should not die on the gallows. Anyway, what his opinion was, I don't know, I can tell you that. So he got the news about it. It was Erev Yom Kippur, before he went to shul. This is true. So, and he knew in Russia, I mean, bribes worked wonders. Still a good thing. It worked. What wonders in Russia? I mean, the Jews couldn't survive, I mean, all the persecution in Russia. They didn't have this magical, how to say, fantasy of bribing the officials. So he thought that if he'll bribe the Ispravnik, Ispravnik was the head of police, and the Ispravnik will give testimony about the character of the boy was a nice boy, he might have been involved or not, so he'll save the boy. The trial was to take place, I mean, you keep a morning in Warsaw, right? It's a night, it's about 7 hours travel, at the time, 7-8 hours travel. So, but you needed at least 10,000 rubles, 10,000 rubles at the time, it was a lot of money, it was 1906, So he closed all shuls in Kippur, you know what in Kippur Eve meant in Brisk 50 years ago. So he closed all shuls. He opened only one shul, the so-called the Pole shul, the big shul. And he told all Jews of Brisk to come to that shul. No one knew for what. For what purpose? All shuls in Brisk, there were about 25 of them, sure, tremendous community. All shuls were closed. All Jews had to stream to that shul. He came to that shul for Kolmidre, you know, for the service. Everything was ready, and he went up and pulpit. He said, gentlemen, I want you to go home. Open your safes, not safes, your drawers. Take all the money you need, you have. Bring the money to shul. We would not take a nidre tonight. We'll collect money. I mean, the people thought that the rabbi is out of his mind. He was out of his mind. I mean, you know what it meant? 50 years ago in Brisk, in Kippur, a nidre told people to go home and handle money and carry money. It's a true story. I mean, I'm not adding one word. I mean, I don't know how you know about it. How did you get...
My father was...
So I thought my father was present there. So and he and the members of the rabbinate of Brisk, was a great community, went up the platform. Instead of saying, everybody, but since the rabbi said, I mean, this is in order. I mean, the rabbi is crazy in his right senses, so it's a different problem, but in order, even from a crazy rabbi, is in order. So it was carried out, and the people began to bring money. Hitler, in no time, the amount of $10,000 was raised. So instead of saying Kol Nidre, he told the people to wait with the service, and he, with a group of prominent laymen of the community, went to the so-called Ispravnik, the police commissioner of this, and they talked to him, and they gave him, I don't know how they gave him, this is a different story, skillfully gave him the money,
And the Spravnik, the commissioner of police, asked my grandfather to sign an affidavit on behalf of his boy. To sign Yom Kippur an affidavit, you know, the night of Yom Kippur. My father signed affidavit, right? My grandfather signed affidavit right away. He spawned me to the train the same night. He came to Warsaw morning to the trial, and as police commissioner, as a Russian police commissioner, he testified that he's convinced in the innocence of the boy, and he was acquitted. Yeah, what does it show? It shows all the greatness and part of my grandfather, yes. I mean, I'll come and I'll speak about loving-kindness, Dhaka. I have many stories like that. But what does it show? I mean, with regard to that.
But even in that instance, though...
He felt collectively responsible, of course. It's collective responsibility. Collective responsibility, of course. Collective responsibility. It's not only that he felt if the boy had been found guilty, the guilt would be shared by the community, but there were two reasons. First of all, the sharing of... Because if the boy had been found guilty, the guilt would have been shared by the community. Secondly, simply an act of mercy and sympathy and compassion to the boy. Yes, and it actually, I mean, the idea of collective moral accountability is mentioned in the Bible. You know, I'm a rabbi, I go back to the Bible. It's mentioned in the Bible. If you open the Bible, Numbers 16. Number 16, just a moment. Yes, number 16, verse 22. Verse 21, 22. Number 16, verse 20, 21, 22. And the Lord spoke unto Moses and unto Aaron, saying, separate yourself from the among this cup, a congregation, that I may consume them in a moment. They sinned. It was the story with Korah. And they fell upon their faces and said, for God, the God of the spirits of all flesh, shall one man sin? And wilt thou be wroth with all the congregation? It was a question mark. O ish echad yechate, one man sin? And your wrath will avenge itself upon the whole congregation? It's a question mark, and God did not say no. Apparently, it's a fact. It's more a rhetorical question. This is already collective responsibility. One was involved, the community paid the price. And of course, the Jewish law, the Jewish law of Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh LaZeh, every Jew halakhically is responsible for the commitments of his other fellow man. Yes. And what you, fantastic, doctor.
I want to ask you a basic question, Father. This charisma, this idea of covenant.
Yes.
And it's an experience.
Sure.
From childhood on.
It's implanted, yes.
Charles, do you think there's any possibility of transmitting it to young adults?
I'll tell you, Dr. Eisenberg, you as an educator is interested in this problem. I'm also interested. We'll come to this problem, how practically to develop that. But let us limit ourselves now to theory. Of course, I know you're interested in that, as an educator. Yeah, this is the idea of collective responsibility for individual culpability. It reflects unfavorably upon the community as such. They may be blamed for the errors of the one. They share the blame, which logically should be confined to the evildoer. It's a strange form of ethical solidarity, comes to the fore. That is why our sages said, and it's important, for modern Jews, very much, that a Jew involved in a public scandal, or in any transgression, or in any indecent deed, or something, and not only this particular deed is morally culpable, morally or juridically culpable, when there is no element of culpability. You know, there are many things we do, we are underlined, as we say, of course, underlined, you know. But many things we do, I told once a lawyer in Boston. He says he's underlined. I said, yes, underlined, but you can do many things which are, although, I mean, you can put one in jail for that, but they are very, I wouldn't even say they're immoral. They're even more, judged by formal standards, they're moral too. But it's still, I don't know how to, I didn't know any adjective how to describe it, but it don't belong into, a Jew should not practice it. Something one is vulgar. Vulgarity is not immoral, no?
I mean, there's no injunction against vulgarity. There's no injunction against bad manners. One can display bad manners in the streetcar or in a restaurant or on the street. I mean, there is no moral norm against exhibitionism. When Jews begin to exhibit their wealth or whatever they are, whatever they have, they possess, and their paintings or their jewelry or their mink coats. I mean, of course, mink coats are only women. I mean, men, I don't know what men exhibit. Oh, and there's something else. I mean, there is no moral law, but it's vulgar. Is even anything public in public vulgar act or insolence, arrogance, the part of the Jew? Oh, even though no moral wrong has been committed, is the Jew has perpetrated a double crime. First of all, if the act is culpable, it's dead in itself. And secondly, the crime reflects unfavorably upon the Jewish community. That's exactly what we call in the halacha, chilul Hashem. And on the contrary, if a Jew reflects credit upon the Jewish community, that's what we call kiddush Hashem. It's a central norm. If you'll open the books, you'll find this norm. It is Leviticus. It is Leviticus 60. Leviticus 22. Leviticus 22, verse 32. And ye shall keep my commandments. Leviticus 22, verse 32. And you shall keep my commandments and do them. I am the Lord. And you shall not profane my holy name. But I will be hallowed or sanctified among the children of Israel. How can one sanctify God? By not reflecting discredit upon the Jewish community. Because God and the community are one.
Also create a great deal of intolerance, because if your life is so interdependent on other people and you share in this kind of responsibility.
You are right. There is an element of risk there. You are right. But about tolerance, and it's a different problem. I'll come to tolerance yet. But there is a... basically, I mean, we don't preach. We try to educate. I mean, of course, there is an element because I'm personally involved. So I get angry. For instance, there are, within the Jewish society, you'll take, for instance, certain groups, I don't want to mention names, who are more on the fringe. I mean, on the fringe, they are easily scared by a public scandal about a Jew. So they sometimes engage in certain absurd, I would say, campaigns, which actually, I mean, are not constructive. But let's first, I mean, just describe it. And Maimonides says, and I'm relevant, there are other things that are a profanation of the name of God. See, my mind is ready. I'm quoting. When a man does things which cause people to talk about him, even if the acts do not express violations, he profanes the name of the God. As for example, if a person makes a purchase and does not pay promptly, provided that he has the means and the creditors ask for the payment, he may put them off. But there is no moral culpability in this. Or if he indulges immoderately in jesting, eating, or drinking, or when his mode of addressing people is not gentle, or he does not receive people affably, but he is quarrelsome and irritable. The greater the man is, the more scrupulous should he be in all such things, and do more than the strict letter of the law requires. If a man has been scrupulous in his conduct, gentle in his conversation, pleasant to his fellow men, affable in manner when receiving them, not retorting even when affronted, but showing courtesy to all, conducting his commercial affairs with integrity, devoting himself to the study of the Torah and doing more than his duty in all things, avoiding extremes and exaggerations, such a man has sanctified God. And concerning him, the scripture says, and he said unto me, thou art my servant to Israel, in whom I take pride, and by whom I am glorified. This is my mind. This is collective responsibility, gentlemen. If you want the source, I can give you. It is Deoth, D-E-O-T-H, 49, column 3. 49, chapter 49, paragraph 3. Yes. In a word, a Jew must always be conscious of his moral responsibility toward his fellow man. Fellow Jew, the guilt of an individual is also shared collectively, and others are accountable for his deeds, which reflect either credit or disgrace upon his people. This is moral togetherness, and this is very important. This is in together. But responsibility expresses itself in something else. And here I come to the concept of tzedakah. This is the moral covenant. Yes, sir?
I'd like to raise a question as to how do we account for the Jew espousing unpopular causes.
What do you call unpopular causes? Sometimes unpopular causes are a very good cause.
Yes, but I mean, if the concern is that a Jew will reflect the concern of the community, the Jewish community,
yes.
This one individual.
I'll tell you frankly, it does not mean that I have to follow the line laid down by the Daily News and the Daily Mirror.
Like
they say. I don't hear that. Oh, no. I spoke about prophetic load. We'll come to concepts of social justice later, what the covenant requires of us in our dealings with the outside society. Oh, no. A Jew, Abraham was one Jew. I mean, the whole world was against him. But what's objectively wrong? I'm not speaking of it. There is a criterion yet. I'll give you an example. I had a case during this McCarthy period, this crazy McCarthy period. Some teacher, he was a teacher of French in a high school here. He was a student at the Yeshiva University. So he was called before the Un-American Committee, the State Committee, and Un-American Activities, and the chairman of the American, the chairman of the State Education Committee, the Juno Silver, who is in servitude to the, I may say publicly, in servitude to the Archbishop of Spelman, you see, he does what Spelman wants him to do. You see, I had my experience with him. So he was called, of course, McCarthy, he was a candidate they discovered in the 30s. And when I'll come to the concept of tshuva, of conversion, repentance, so McCarthy did not have the concept of tshuva. Anyway, they wanted him to disclose the names of his associates. And there were teachers, actually, are teachers in the public school system. So instead of quoting the Fifth Amendment, which is the usual procedure, he said that the Jewish law prohibits squealing in public. And he is a Jew who is committed to a set of moral principles, and he cannot violate them.
So the American Jewish Committee got scared. They are easily scared, American Jewish Committee. So I don't want to tell you the names, but the attorney of the American Jewish Committee called me. It's a public scandal. And what's the public scandal? So he told me the story. The whole Jewish community is involved. You know what the papers will come out? Judaism protects Jewish religion protects communists. So I said to him, I'll tell you, Mr. So-and-so, listen, you want me to give you an answer? I'll give it in writing, and I don't care if this answer will be published in the press. You just address your inquiry to the Law Commission of the Rabbinical Council of America, for which I'm the chairman, and then it'll be my duty, to answer. If no official inquiry is addressed to me, I'm not supposed to answer. So a letter came in, from the chairman of the commission. I don't remember his name now, a gentle fellow. And then it was turned over to me, and he had a fight at the Rabbinic Council of America. Most rabbis said, we cannot now, in such a climate of prejudice and hatred and bigotry, we cannot defend an individual who does not want to disclose the names of his associates. And you saw, it's very easy to become patriotic and employ, pseudo-patriotism. They are a menace to society. The man teaches French, the menace to society. And the other teacher about whom he was supposed to squeal taught physics, you see, a menace to society. And he quit the Communist Party in the 30s. Or this was in the 40s. It was about 1950 or 1951. I don't remember exactly. My memory is not so good. So finally, I wrote a brief, and they never published this brief. And I said, I prohibit, he's a member of the Rabbinical Council, we made him a member of the Rabbinical Council of America. He joined a few months ago. Whether he joined it because he knew it's coming up, I don't know. He was actually ordained. And he's a member of the Rabbinical Council of America, and he's subject to decisions of the Law Commission. I prohibit, I enjoin him by my decision from disclosing any names. And when they asked, and then I said, why? Because first of all, squealing is prohibited. We have to inform the authorities if the person in question is a public menace. But however, I don't see any public menace. even if an associate of him who teaches physics or chemistry or biochemistry, I mean, was a member of the Communist Party 10 years before and quit because he didn't like their policies, because he simply has contempt for them now. And then the trouble is with all these inquiries that you don't know a basic law in the Bible, the law of repentance. A man can sin and come back to God. And that's why I don't dare tell him, I mean, to inform. And they took the letter, and he was not cited for contempt. He was not cited for contempt. The letter was not published by anybody. I don't know where it is now, if I want to find their file somewhere. I mean, I don't say that, but I mean culpability at a higher level. Now, collective responsibility, gentlemen, manifests itself also at the level of tzedakah. What is the idea of tzedakah? You know what tzedakah means in Jewish life, in Jewish law. What is it? Why so much importance? People say because Jews are good. I don't know whether Jews by nature are tender. I don't know. I have questions. It's very simple. Since compassion in total involvement in the destiny of the Tao, at all levels, at intellectual level, at the emotional level, at the moral culpability, level of moral culpability, is the first aspect of the Am Covenant. This existential identification expresses itself in halakhic terms of tzedakah. I must extend assistance to my brother who is in need and cannot help himself. I must share the burden which unfriendly circumstances placed upon his frail shoulders and help him carry this burden. There is something very interesting about tzedakah, which I want you to understand. Basically, what's the equivalent in English? Not in English, it's in Latin. What's the equivalent in Latin, which was anglicized and incorporated into our English vernacular for tzedakah? What is it? Charity. It comes from the Latin caritas. What caritas means is love. That's basically what the Greek agape means. Love, deep love, very deep love, deep love, profound love. Yes, love. Love expressed in deeds. That's what it means. Love expressed in deeds. But basically this translation is very wrong. And I'll explain you why. This translation distorts the whole concept of tzedakah. Caritas in Latin is rather the equivalent for the Hebrew term of chesed. Chesed, you know, means loving kindness. This is basically caritas is the equivalent, means loving kindness. It's almost semantically, it's almost the most exact translation of loving kindness, not of tzedakah. While tzedakah, whoever knows Hebrew, tzedakah and tzedek are the same words. And what does tzedek mean in Hebrew? Justitia, justice. Righteousness. Why the hey was added to the different problem? What is tzedek and tzedakah the same? Why this noun has the feminine form? It's a problem. It's a problem. My mind just tries to solve this problem. What it means, it's justitia. It is justice, righteousness. Let us see, what's the difference between caritas, philosophically? What's the difference between caritas and justitia? They're both Latin terms, justitia and caritas. Or between charity, loving kindness, and righteousness, justice. There is one difference. Justitia is a juridic idea. It's a legalistic term. Caritas is not a legalistic term, not a juridic term. Caritas is a moral term. Law doesn't know anything about caritas. Even in courts of equity, there is no caritas. Equity is also based on justitia. But there are two kinds of justitia. The plain, simple justitia, you loan money, you have to pay. And there is equity, a higher form of justitia. But even courts of equity have nothing to do with caritas. A court cannot decree caritas, cannot tell me what to do. Because caritas itself, basically, means voluntary. Free, uncommitted, self-imposed, flowing out of a free choice. Love, you can't compel one to give you love. You can compel him to live according to the law, But not to give you love, if he refuses to give love, it's no way to compel. Not even a husband can compel his wife. Not even a father can compel his children to give him love. So caritas is of course, love is a moral value. Justice is not only a moral value, it's a juridic value. It's a juridic concept. You understand? The ethos, caritas? Caritas is a question of the ethos. Justice is a concept of the law, of the law and order. If you'll take my Maimonides, just one moment, I want to. My Maimonides in the last chapter, I cannot read it completely because we need more. Chapter 65, last section, third section. He says, my Maimonides, not 65, excuse me, not 65, but 59. No, 53, part 3. He says, chesed denoting an excess. It is especially used of extraordinary kindness. Loving kindness to those who have no claim whatever upon us. This is my man's definition. Third section, chapter 53. Who have no claim whatever upon us. Now, tzedek, the term tzedakah, derived from tzedek, means righteousness. It denotes the act of giving everyone his due and of showing kindness to every being according as he deserves. This is law. He always demands give the other fellow what is due to him. Morality demands from us give every fellow what is not, even what is not due to him. So now, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, so the term tzedakah, if we translate it with caritas, what does it mean? What does it mean, gentlemen? Ladies and gentlemen, what does it mean? If it is caritas, then it means so. It's an act of loving kindness. You see, the man, for instance, it's interesting. The man, for instance, who gives tzedakah, what do you call baal tzedakah? What does it mean? Baal tzedakah means a man of justice, correct? In English, what will you say? How will you say? You'll use the Greek equivalent of philanthrop. What does it mean? Philanthrop means a lover of people. It's love. You see, however you maneuver, when you want to express the idea of tzedakah in English, you take refuge, so to say, in the Greek-Roman worldview. They didn't know anything of charity. I mean, I'll use tzedakah. I should give him, I owe anything to the poor man, I don't owe him anything. The Greek, with their disdain, with their supercilious attitude to our the poor classes, with their disdainful approach, I owe him, I owe something to the slave, I don't owe anything. If I'm a philanthrop, a lover of people, it's a luxury, basically. Of course, I can be very generous. That's all. Very generous. Basically, if you study Greek history or Roman history, you wouldn't find a single incident of tzedakah. They don't know anything. Tzedakah was not enumerated among the virtues formulated by Plato and Aristotle. They don't know anything of tzedakah. Charity? All right, it's a luxury. One likes the arts, I mean, sculpture. Not all one likes to play around with human beings and shower love upon them. For instance, because of that, no Western system of law in Western society has ever said that tzedakah, the charity, can be collected, compulsorily collected from people. That you can sit down, assess a man, his financial, so to say, circumstances, fix an amount which he's supposed to give, must give, according to financial reports, and collect the amount from him. I mean, if such a bill should be introduced in Congress or in any legislature or general assembly, in any of the 48 states, people would say the senator or the Congress or the member of the House who introduces such legislation that is not in his right senses. Because the basic idea of charity means freedom. Because it is not a juridic category. It's not a juridic norm. For instance, thou shalt not steal is a juridic norm, but thou shalt help the poor is not a juridic norm, gentlemen. This is a moral norm. Morality, what's the difference between law and morality? Law is enforceable, morality is inenforceable. You cannot enforce morality. Morality is the element of freedom. While the moral norm can be enforced, a man can be compelled to comply with the moral norm. The act, thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt pay your debts, and so forth. This is exactly what is the Roman Greek concept. It was adapted by Western society.
Well, isn't this true?
It is.
I'm just wondering about in contemporary times, this whole struggle in the Supreme Court in terms of the desegregation, in some respects, reflects what I would think a kind of moral law as well as a legalistic law.
A legalistic law because the Constitution, as it was enacted, and since, I mean, equality is a constitutional, I mean, term, so it becomes law. I mean, but now the new concept of tzedakah, which is alien completely to any system of law adopted by civilized society, is different. The Jewish law says that tzedakah is a juridic term. And tzedakah, you know what was? This is the law and this was the practice throughout the generations. There was assessment. Like now there is assessment of taxes, there was assessment for tzedakah. Bedin, or whoever it is, the community or the court, used to sit down, simply, I mean, appraise objectively the circumstances of a member of the community, assessing not only with taxes, with regard to taxes. This was a different assessment. How much tzedakah he must give. What difference it is, whatever it is. Whatever it is, self-government. Of course, if we have no self-government, we couldn't assess. Because in the Middle Ages we had self-government, in Babylonia we had self-government, but it goes back to the Second Commonwealth. As a matter of fact, they used to assess individuals, and the individual refused to pay, so they used simply take away his property, sell it, the method of foreclosure, and collect the amount which was fixed and raised upon this particular individual. And the famous statement in Baba Batra, with which Maimonides quotes it in his famous chapters on tzedakah, Memashkinin al tzedakah. You can sell property in order to collect tzedakah, which was assessed and fixed with regard to one individual. Afilu barve Shabbatot, even on Friday afternoon, when all courts are closed. So you open the court for this session, for this particular act. You give an edict of collection, what do you call it, and you collect tzedakah. Why is it so? It's strange. Why is it so? Why is it so? Because tzedakah depends upon our experience, upon the existential community, the awareness of togetherness, which manifests itself in social responsibility, in sympathy, requiring a welfare action. It places a duty, not a moral duty, but a legalistic duty, a juridic duty. This is not an act of charity, of compliance, but an act of compliance with a legal duty enforceable by the courts. This goes back to the covenant in Egypt. Am together. Basically, it means that our property rights are not parochial. They are community property rights. But otherwise, that the poor man has a right to my property. And if I refuse to give him his share, it's like, it is a violation in contravention of a juridic norm, of the law. Like, as if I had loaned money and refused to pay the creditor. This is basically the community of responsibilities. It finally results in a community of property. Of course, the community of property had to be, restricted, but this is basically. Basically, private property is non-existent in Judaism. I'll come to it later. First of all Jews may share your property. Of course, the Jew needs it. If there is no need, I must. And of course, sharing does not mean by unilateral action on the part of the poor should just come into the house and take away. It must be enforced. It must have, so to say, it must employ legal procedure. But with legal procedure, a poor man can come according to the law. It's a funny law. A poor man can come in a city and say, this man is rich, and I am starving. I want him to support me. The court, with upon request, will assess possibilities, of course. Inquire, assess possibility, whether the man can make a living, and if the court should find out that this poor man cannot make a living, he's helpless. And he's the only one who can support him. There's no one else in the community. So court can write an edict of collection. And by writing an edict of collection, it means it becomes a debt. This is the Jewish law. This is halacha. This is not my philosophy, my experience. And this is based upon the covenant of Am, together. Together at all levels. At the level of destiny, interests, feelings, experiences, moral responsibilities, and welfare responsibilities. And finally, together in property, in ownership. All right?
This concludes our presentation of A Jewish Philosophy of Man, a lecture series by Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. Although there were four more lectures to the 12-part series, recordings of the last four lectures have yet to be found. If you know any information about where those recordings may be found, please contact us at the Tradition website, traditiononline.org. My name is Mark Smilowitz, and I want to thank all those who had a hand in restoring and publicizing these lectures, especially Dr. Tova Lichtenstein for her kind permission to share these lectures, Jeffrey Sachs of Tradition for supervising the production of this project, and Reuven Ziegler of the Torah Sarov Foundation for his help in locating and organizing the lectures. The musical intro and outro come from pieces by Paul Nottorp, an early 20th century German philosopher and composer whose thought influenced Rav Soloveitchik's ideas about the relationship between Jewish law and subjective Jewish experience. For more on that topic, see my doctoral dissertation linked at traditiononline.org/jpm.